KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
He'd always say, pray for me. And be like, well, wait a minute, Your Holiness, you're supposed to be praying for the rest of us.
Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House Emerita, is one of many voices we're hearing from today as we remember Pope Francis I.
For Monday, April 21st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, what you need to know about how the next pope will be chosen.
Also, how Trump immigration policy is upending the horse racing industry.
They're worried for their friends, for some of their relatives, and they are also worried that if they go home, will they be able to come back?
And you know how bats come swooping out of the caves, thousands of them all at once?
Yeah, and they never crash into each other. Why?
These ultrasonic microphones that allow us to record the echolocation of the specific bat, but also the other bats that fit around it.
Staking out a bat cave in Israel after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. For some younger Catholics, Pope Francis, who died this morning at the age of 88, was a church leader they thought of as their own, concerned about the environment, the poor, and peace. NPR's Jason DeRose has more on how some say they will remember him.
At St. Monica's Catholic Church in Santa Monica, California, 29-year-old Daniel Trin is an active member. After falling away from the church, Trin became interested again because of Francis' emphasis on serving the most vulnerable.
Just the fact that he picked Francis as his pope name. St. Francis, he was born very rich, but he gave up everything so that he could help those who were in need.
Trin says Pope Francis led him to think about the kind of person he wanted to be, a person who lives out his faith in loving service to others. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Santa Monica.
Harvard is suing the Trump administration, continuing its fight against efforts to pull billions of dollars in federal funding from the university. NPR's Janaki Mehta has more.
The lawsuit alleges the government is trying to, quote, leverage to gain control of academic decision-making at Harvard. This comes after Harvard refused to comply with a long list of demands from the Trump administration to overhaul its admissions, hiring, and other policies, including diversity, inclusion, and equity programs. The administration fired back by freezing more than $2.2 billion in federal funding and threatening to revoke Harvard's tax-exempt status. In the past week, it has also threatened to eliminate visas for international students at Harvard. Now, the nation's oldest university is taking on the White House in court. Harvard's President Alan Garber said the consequences of the Trump administration's attack would be, quote, severe and long-lasting. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is once again on the defensive. NPR has confirmed that he used his personal cell phone last month to provide his wife, brother, and his lawyer with classified information about airstrikes on Houthi targets in Yemen. This was on the same day that Hegseth provided similar information in a Signal chat with senior U.S. officials, as well as a journalist who was mistakenly placed on that call. NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
Hegseth was at the White House Easter egg roll today and did not address the second Signal chat directly, but instead said anonymous sources, disgruntled former employees, were behind this. He said they, quote, slash and burn people and ruin the reputations. President Trump at the same event praised Hegseth and called the story false.
In the past 4 weeks, four senior advisors to Hegseth have left abruptly and suggested that Pentagon infighting is hurting President Trump. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt slammed NPR's reporting on this issue as fake news. U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. Dow futures are up about 0.2%. This after Wall Street was sharply lower by the close. You're listening to NPR News. The Education Department says next month it will resume garnishing tax refunds and government benefits for people in default on their student loans. It ends a five-year pause on collections because of the pandemic, and wage garnishments restart this summer. More than 5 million borrowers are in default, failing to make a payment on their loan for at least 360 days before the government stopped referring past debt to collection agencies during the pandemic. And millions are in delinquency, at least 60 days late on their payments. The rise in delinquencies corresponds to an end of the 12-month grace period that allowed borrowers to ease back into repayment after the pandemic pause. The agency says less than 40% of student loan borrowers are current on their loans. There's concern that therapists don't have privacy because of overcrowding at VA facilities. NPR's Katia Riddle has more.
The memo appears to mandate that VA therapists have private spaces. It follows reporting from NPR suggesting clinicians at the VA would have to conduct telehealth therapy sessions with headsets in shared offices. Lynn Bufka is with the American Psychological Association. The organization raised alarm about privacy.
Confidentiality between the patient and the clinician can be protected with things like four walls and a door so that people aren't seeing who's with the therapist or hearing what's being said.
The VA has said repeatedly that veterans will be guaranteed private therapy sessions. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
On Wall Street at the closing bell today, the Dow was down nearly 2.5%, NASDAQ down 2.5%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, committed to upholding the principles of responsible research as they work to develop AI technologies to enhance research around the world. Learn more at EBSCO.com. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Thousands of mourners gathered in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican today to pray and say goodbye to Pope Francis. He led the Catholic Church for 12 years and died on Monday at the age of 88. His papacy challenged old traditions. Francis was the first Latin American pope, born in 1936 in Argentina. He called for action on the environment, on helping the poor, and on welcoming migrants. He asked the church to consider giving a bigger role to women, and he was seen as friendlier to the LGBTQ faithful than any previous pontiff. NPR's Ruth Sherlock joins us now from Rome. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so tell us what you've been hearing from people today as they're mourning.
Well, there have been emotional scenes from St. Peter's Square. You know, at the prayers we just heard, people in the crowd were in tears. This was a popular pope. And as people mourn, Elsa, they're also thinking about his legacy. We spoke with Amikan Johansen from Norway, who came to see Pope Francis at yesterday's Easter Mass and talks about his legacy.
His legacy will be about many things, not the least compassion and humility and his courage to criticize the rulers and openness and kindness.
You know, in speaking about criticizing leaders there, she's referring to Pope Francis's outspoken stance on the war in Gaza, which at times brought pushback from Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. And then Doug Rand from Montana, well, he remembers how the Pope was known for being indefatigable. He would work these long hours, even from his sickbed, Rand says, also to advocate for the less fortunate.
This is a man who gave everything. And he did it right up to the last day. And he was always working for the little guy and the poor and the disadvantaged and the abused. He did the right thing.
These are some of the memories that will come to make up Pope Francis's legacy.
Yeah, such an outpouring from everywhere. And, you know, Ruth, there's been reaction from all over the world. What have you noted in particular?
Yeah, there's been church bells tolling from Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris to the churches in the Philippines. J.D. Vance, the U.S. vice president, who was just with the Pope on Easter Sunday, said his heart goes out to the millions of Christians who loved Francis. Muslim leaders have also been among the first to offer condolences. And the Dalai Lama honored Francis, saying he lived a simple but meaningful life.
We know that the Pope had been sick for a while, but of course he appeared at Easter Mass yesterday. There have been quite a few recent public appearances. Does that all make news of his death feel quite sudden, you think?
You know, it does. He had been battling double pneumonia and was admitted to hospital in February. And in that time, his illness became critical. There were prayers for him in St. Peter's Square, and people didn't know if he was going to pull through. But then he came out of hospital 5 weeks later and was convalescing at his home in the Vatican and had started to make these public appearances, like at the Easter Mass yesterday.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buona Pasqua.
But then, this morning, the Vatican announced that at 7:35 a.m. local time, Pope Francis today had passed away, and the Vatican says he died of a stroke and cardiac arrest.
So what happens next at the Vatican in the coming days?
There's the ceremonial confirmation of the Pope's death, in which the Vatican Camerlengo, or Chamberlain, he calls out the late Pope's baptismal name three times, and then when there's no response, he declares the sede vacante, the holy see is vacant. The Pope's room is sealed off using red wax seals, and then the Chamberlain breaks the deceased Pope's signet ring. People are going to be able to view the Pope's body in the open coffin at St. Peter's, and his funeral will take place in 4 to 6 days after his death. The Pope has been calling for a simpler funeral. You know, past popes were put in three nested coffins, for example, but Pope Francis has asked to be buried in a single coffin made of wood and lined in zinc.
And what do we know about the preparations ahead of the conclave to choose the next Pope?
Cardinals are coming from across the world, and they'll first gather for these meetings known as the General Congregations. These are before the official conclave, which happens 15 to 20 days after the Pope's passing. But these meetings can be incredibly important, as this is where, you know, a lot of the nitty-gritty, a lot of the discussion and lobbying actually takes place about the priorities for the next papacy.
That is NPR's Ruth Sherlock in Rome. Thank you so much, Ruth.
Thank you, Elsa.
Pope Francis was the leader of the world's 1.4 billion Catholics. He was also a political leader. Nancy Pelosi encountered Francis in both roles. The Speaker of the House Emerita joins me now to remember him. Madam Speaker, welcome back to All Things Considered.
My pleasure. I wish it were for a different occasion.
As
but
do
nonetheless.
I. Yeah. I remember when you and I spoke last summer, I was interviewing you about your memoir, your book. And you talked about growing up Catholic and how today your faith remains very deep. So just say a little bit more about that, what Pope Francis's death means to you personally.
Well, his death means a great deal to me personally, but to many, many Catholics and people of faith throughout the world. So that's why it's such a day of sadness. I had the occasion, I was at his installation on the Feast of St. Joseph. Then I had four opportunities to visit with him and speak with him, sometimes with my children, sometimes officially, and always inspired by him. He would always say, Mary Louise, he would always say, pray for me. And be like, well, wait a minute, Your Holiness, you're supposed to be praying for the rest of us. So this the sign of his humility, pray for me, and then this confidence and his courage to do all the wonderful things that he did was quite remarkable. Humble and courageous and confident.
And it sounds like you're praying for him today. When was the last time?
I'm praying to him today. I'm praying to him today.
When was the last time you saw him or were able to speak with him?
Last time I saw him, we visited St. Peter's, of course, on the Feast of St. Peter and Paul. Then they called me outside and said, before His Holiness arrived, they said, we want you to wait here. And we just waited there, my husband and I, Paul and I. Mm-hmm. And then the door opened and in came His Holiness in a wheelchair at a distant door, but he stood up and walked over to where we were. And we had this beautiful chat and it was photographed and they put it out there publicly. That was the last time I saw him. Right before that, though, is when I had the private visit with him in his office. And they told me when we went there, these rules are very strict. They're 400 years old, so you must obey all the rules. And so when I went to see him at his office, as soon as the door opened, I was facing him. He was standing on the other side of the door, and tears just flowed down my eyes. I was just overwhelmed by seeing him. But how he reacted is what really got me, is he just laughed and laughed and laughed that I was so tearful upon seeing him.
He was, of course, a spiritual leader and also a political one. This was not a man afraid of a fight. I'm thinking, for example, about the positions he took in LGBTQ rights, transgender rights. Yeah. At a moment when those are being walked back here in the U.S., what does it mean for the world to have lost his voice at this moment?
Well, we'll go. Able to stay alive for Easter. That was remarkable. And then this morning when we heard the news, it was, of course he stayed here one more day. So beautiful.
Speaker of the House Emerita Nancy Pelosi, remembering Pope Francis, who died today at age 88. Nancy Pelosi, thank you. Great to speak with
you
again.
Thank you, Mary Louise. Thank you so much.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet on Earth Day and every day through the bold power of local and global action. nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The weather may be getting warmer, but for most of us, we are still a ways out from swimming weather, though not so for a group who call themselves the Brave Souls. The women who plunge into the icy waters of the Connecticut River each week are featured in a podcast by Dartmouth student Eliza Dunn. Her story was one of this year's finalists in NPR's College Podcast Challenge.
I'm at a boat launch just off of Route 5 in Norwich, Vermont. It's late February, and it's bitter cold. Alongside three other women, I'm getting ready to go for a swim.
So I came dressed in, like, a wearable blanket, sweatpants, wool socks, and tennis shoes with my bathing suit under.
This is Allie Evans, one of the members of an Upper Valley cold water dipping group called the Brave Souls. The other women here are also buried under layers of clothing. But when it's time to swim, they all strip down to bathing suits. Before I know it, they're wading into the river, pushing away floating blocks of ice.
I did not fall at all.
The timer starts, 3 minutes on the clock. When I learned about the Brave Souls here in the Upper Valley, I knew I needed to join them for a dip.
But in those really cold days, we've had to, like, kind of break through the ice to be able to get into the water. We just crushed right through it.
This is Amy Green. Amy essentially serves as the main organizer of the Brave Souls, even though she just moved to Norwich over the summer from northern Vermont. And not long after that, she roped in her new friend Kendra, who's also pretty new to the Upper Valley.
Kendra Littner, I live in Hanover, New Hampshire. When I went for the first time, I knew nothing. I didn't know you stay there for 3 minutes, which is insane.
Amy and Kendra have very different takes on what happens next.
When I go in, the instant pain is terrible. Like, what are you doing?
I like to just, like, I take in the beauty, and then I'm always just reminding everybody, like, look how beautiful, like, distract yourself.
I feel like Amy's always like, oh, turn to the sunset, sunset. She'll be like, look, we're here, and the sun is shining. Like, very calm, relaxing stuff. Makes me want to punch her in the face.
Oh, actually, the face didn't feel that nice.
Yeah.
Yes,
I like the swim. I like getting that.
And then the timer goes off. The Brave Souls have been in the water for a little over 3 minutes.
Yes!
When you get out, like, it's almost like just having, like, a rush of caffeine or a rush of adrenaline. Like, you're just like, yes. And I feel like just super, I want to say happy. Like, your body just kind of, like, feels so good. Like, you've done something for yourself.
So how's everyone feeling?
Great. Ooh, excellent. I feel energized and surprisingly not cold yet.
At first, it was that post-dip feeling that kept them coming back to dip. But now, after months of consistent dipping, both Amy and Kendra say it's more than the feeling that keeps them going.
I really think it's about being with other people.
The group is, they're nuts. I need nuts. Nuts keeps me going. This is something, I have no idea what it does, but it's definitely brought me closer to people that I, again, said would have never met.
And through it all, here in the Connecticut River, they've forged a sense of home. And not just in a normal way, in a crazy, breathless, shrieking, cursing kind of way. And at the end of every dip, the Brave Souls bundle back up. They crank the heat in their cars, and they promise each other that they'll be back next week.
That story was from NPR College Podcast Challenge finalist Eliza Dunn.
Horse racing season is here. The fastest horses at some of America's most popular races are supported by dozens of workers. They spend every day grooming, walking, raising the horses to be winners. Well, many of those workers are immigrants. As the 2025 horse racing season ramps up, employers who hire them on visas are watching to see what the Trump administration's stricter immigration policy may mean for them. Here's NPR's Jimena Bustillo with more.
Racehorse trainers gather around the track at Laurel Park in Maryland. Six horses are led into the green metal gates and then they are literally off to the races, galloping around the mile-long sandy track in barely a minute. It's an exciting moment as the first muddy horse pushes across the finish line. The jockey, also caked in mud, breathes easy, knowing that he has won the big prize. It's not an easy journey getting a horse to the track, and trainers say that work depends on immigrants.
Everyone is an immigrant. I think we rely 100% on immigrants.
That is Diana Piñones. She says H-2B visas, which are for non-agricultural seasonal labor, are needed to find workers to groom, walk, and raise the horses. She's the executive assistant at Laurel Park, and she helps the migrant workers settle in.
I treat them like family, and they do the same thing. They treat me like family. It's a big family.
Family. It's a common theme in the horse racing world. Those in the industry say that it is made possible by the generations of individual families who come to the U.S. on H-2B visas year after year. Piñones said, like many others, her family came to the U.S. from Michoacán.
Mi mamá y mi papá se han dedicado a este trabajo toda su vida.
My mom and dad dedicated themselves to this work all their lives. As a child, I would come here. That's how I got into this work.
Así fue como llegué a este trabajo.
Mexico is the top country for H-2B visa holders, followed by Jamaica, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. The visas are used by employers when they can't find anyone domestically to do the work. H-2B visas have an annual cap of 66,000, a cap already reached this year, and employers are taking note.
They can look and see that the border is much tighter than it was before, and that affects both legal and illegal workers coming across the border.
That's Lyndon Melmed of BAL, an immigration law firm.
What we hear is that they are certainly looking at those visa categories as a way to say, we need to secure a consistent workforce because we're not really sure how these immigration enforcement trends are going to affect, you know, current employees and future employees.
The trainers at Laurel Park are set for this year, but Piñones said that there's already uncertainty about visa availability for next year.
We still don't see it because everybody who had a visa had him come here in October, November, so we still don't see it, but eventually it will hurt the industry.
That fear is felt across the board.
Come on, girl.
Ferris Allen has been a racehorse trainer for 27 years. He stands by a white picket fence, cheering on, taking notes, and checking his watch as one of his horses, a glossy brown one with a number 6 tag, races through the finish.
We finished fourth.
As he waits for another one of his horses, named Who Says So, to run, he tells me the visa process is very complex.
Oftentimes it's very daunting to skate through all of this stuff.
And he has also heard concerns from his workers.
The workers that I have are all within legal status, but that doesn't mean everyone they associate with here is. So they're worried for their friends and for some of their relatives. And they're also worried that if they go home, will they be able to come back?
Allen calls these workers essential. Without them, his own family business wouldn't continue. He and others in the industry are cautiously hopeful they will be able to bring in more workers to help them race next season. Ximena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
The Catholic Church begins 9 days of official mourning after the death of Pope Francis. Various rituals are planned, all leading up to the selection of a new pontiff by the College of Cardinals. Now, as the world reacts to the news, many are wondering what's next for the Church. We'll explore the possibilities on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, a primer on the conclave.
That's the College of Cardinals who will elect the next pope.
There's lots of names circulating, but there's no real front runners.
Plus, the latest from St. Peter's Square and our reporting team in Rome.
That's ahead, right after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. At the Vatican and in the surrounding city of Rome, preparations are underway for the final goodbye to the first Latin American prelate to have led the Catholic Church. Vatican officials say Pope Francis died from heart failure after suffering a stroke on Easter Monday. The final months of his life, he was extremely ill with multiple respiratory ailments. In the United States, Catholics like 28-year-old Natalie Borrego of Austin, Texas, recalled his dedication to society's most humble.
He really had a heart for the poorest of the poor, and I think he really inspired and strengthened my dedication to the Catholic faith.
Bishop Carl Kemi of Wichita, Kansas, remembers meeting the Pope.
His warmth, his ingratiating smile, his humility, his simple way of living.
Final services for Pope Francis are expected in the coming week. More than 200 former diplomats and top State Department officials are warning of what they call an assault on American democracy by the Trump administration. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports they have signed an open letter.
The retired diplomats who have served in both Republican and Democratic administrations say they've worked in countries where democratically elected leaders follow a path to autocracy. And they say they know this requires a united front. So they've issued a call to action, urging former presidents, secretaries of state and defense to publicly challenge the Trump administration's, quote, dangerous policies. They say law firms, business leaders, universities, and the media should respond to policies that affect them. Waiting for the next election to fight back, they warn, gives the administration, quote, running room to impose its authoritarian stamp on all of us. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 971 points. The S&P 500 lost 124. This is NPR. Adding to anxieties in financial markets today, President Trump's bitter criticism of Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, who has signaled he is not prepared to lower interest rates soon. Powell has cited the likelihood that Trump's tariffs will cause inflation to go back up. President Trump called on the central bank to lower its key interest rates. The National Institutes of Health today unveiled a new policy that could cut off funding to any institution that has its own DEI policy or any boycotts involving Israel. NPR's Rob Stein has more.
Interim U.S. Attorney Edward R. Martin Jr. sent letters to scientific journals published by the American Medical Association and the American College of Chest Physicians. One of the journals, called Chest, confirmed receiving the letter. Neither Martin's office nor the other journal, called JAMA, responded to NPR's request for comment. Other journals may have also received the letter. The letter charges the journals are, quote, partisans in various scientific debates. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Starting next month, the Education Department will begin collection on student loans in default. This could include garnishing wages for potentially millions of borrowers through the Treasury Department's offset program. It's estimated that around 5 million borrowers are in default on their loans. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. As Catholics around the world mourn Pope Francis, centuries-old rituals are already playing out, rituals that will include choosing the next pope, the conclave. That's the College of Cardinals who will elect Pope Francis's successor, will begin 15 to 20 days after his death. To walk us through what happens next, I want to bring in Father Tom Reese of Religion News Service. Welcome back to All Things Considered, and my condolences on a sad day in the church.
Thank you. It is a sad day, but we're happy for him. He's in a better place.
How are you remembering him today?
I remember him as someone who really changed the culture of the church. This is a man who hated clericalism. He kept telling bishops and priests to not act like princes, but to be with their people.
So, like many people listening to us, I feel like I know how a conclave works because I saw the movie last year. What should we know about the process that is about to unfold?
Well, all of the cardinal electors will be coming to Rome for the Pope's funeral. That's 135 cardinals who are under the age of 80. Mm-hmm. 80% of those have been appointed by Pope Francis. So they will gather in the Sistine Chapel, and twice a day they will have a vote, and that will be done in silence and in prayer. Outside of the Sistine Chapel, there will be lots of conversations about who should be Pope.
And give us a little bit of insight into those conversations. What are the priorities supposed to be?
Well, I think each cardinal is looking for three things in a future pope. First, he wants someone who will be a good pope, which of course means that the candidate agrees with the cardinal on the future of the church. The second thing he wants is someone who he has a good relationship with, because he wants to be able to have someone who will listen to him after he becomes pope. And finally, he wants someone elected who will go down well in his part of the world, in his country.
Are there already names circulating, front runners?
There's lots of names circulating, but there's no real front runners. You know, when John Paul II was elected, it was a big surprise. When Francis was elected, it was a big surprise. It may be a surprise.
How big a factor is geography? Much has been made of the fact that Francis was the first non-European to hold that role in 1,000 years.
Geography is extremely important because different parts of the world have different concerns. The global south is very concerned about poverty, about the economic system, about globalization, about wars, and they're concerned about migrants and refugees trying to find safe places to live. On the other hand, you know, the people in the north, we're very strong on ecumenism, we're very strong on having good relations with the Jewish community. These are important things to us. We're very strong on taking care of the sex abuse crisis, making sure that this does not happen again. So there are different priorities in different parts of the world, but we may see how that plays out.
I mean, this selection process is about as far from transparent as it feels possible to get. They will be sealed inside the Sistine Chapel. Will we ever get visibility into why whoever is chosen the next pope was chosen?
Well, of course, when the cardinals come out, each one of them can talk about why he likes the new pope or doesn't like the new pope. So we'll get that, but we certainly will not know how each person votes. The cardinals themselves will not even know that. It's a secret ballot, and the ballots are burned after they're counted.
Father Tom Reese, he's a journalist, author, and Jesuit priest. He writes the Signs of the Times column for Religion News Service. Father Reese, thank you.
Good to be with you.
How do you navigate losing a job? That question has been on the minds of tens of thousands of federal employees as the Trump administration continues to terminate workers. A financial cushion helps, of course, but research shows that other factors can also determine how well someone weathers a job loss. NPR's Kadia Riddle has more.
One of the most difficult things about losing a job, especially a job that you love, is that it becomes part of your identity. Like for this man, John, who worked for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as a program analyst, he remembers taking an oath there on his first day.
You stand up and, you know, put your hand over your heart, and you take the same oath that elected officials take to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. It was just one of the proudest moments of my life.
John is 39. He was cut from the CDC a few weeks ago. Since then, some of his colleagues that were also fired were doxxed, and he's worried about that happening to him. That's why he asked to use only his first name. John upheld his oath at the CDC for 14 years. He was awarded Employee of the Month for the entire agency at one point. Now he's wondering who he is.
I want to be a public servant. I want to help people. It's a part of me.
Some who study the impact of job loss say people need to process this kind of grief. If not, they may struggle to move forward. Jeffrey Anvari Clark is a professor of social work at the University of North Dakota. He's looked at identity issues around job loss in his research.
People didn't know how to handle that, and that's what made it perhaps an even bigger catastrophe than just simply having a reduction in income.
Anvari Clark has done research that shows that job loss can compromise physical and mental health. He says in addition to identity loss, the way people think about their finances can have an even greater impact than their actual financial situation.
And particularly when we start getting into money disorders, that it actually doesn't matter how much money you have, it's how you feel about it. And so you can have people who are billionaires and who still feel like, I don't have enough.
People who can avoid these snags are less likely to get bogged down in despair, he says. But the difference between theory and practice on this directive can be vast. John, for example, is disabled. He's struggling not to be despondent over his finances.
I've always had a plan to have more in retirement than the normal person because I'm going to need specialized care, and the cost of that care is probably only going to go up.
When he was a teenager, he had an accident that left him paralyzed. He says what he would receive on disability would not be enough.
The absolute worst case scenario for me is ending up in a nursing home under the age of 40.
But he has been keeping himself busy working on a public health AI project. He says that's helping.
That's really given me a lot of energy and kind of kept me going.
This is exactly the kind of thing experts like Anvari Clark advise people to do. Even if it's not paid work, it brings connection, a sense of purpose. And John says if there's one thing his disability has given him, it's tenacity.
I had to relearn how to do everything again after my injury. You get really good at problem solving.
Losing his job, he says, is one of the single biggest problems he's ever had to solve. Kadia Riddle, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump has not been shy about it. He wants the U.S. to use more coal, even though most utilities have turned away from it. West Virginia produces and consumes a lot of coal, and it's made electricity there more expensive. Curtis Tate of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more on how this push for more coal clashes with the state's economic realities.
Mary West is an Army veteran who lives in Beckley in southern West Virginia's coal field. She used to work in the mines locally in about 1980. West called it hard and dangerous work. An injury put an end to her brief career in mining.
They released me to go back to work, and I told them I was not going to go back because the Lord hid it underground for a reason and didn't intend for my crazy butt to keep going down there finding it.
Her past in coal isn't obvious when looking at her red brick home. The roof is lined with solar panels. Most months, she pays nothing for electricity. For others, it's a struggle. Tom Mosley is a retired postal worker.
Most families in Raleigh County are living to pay bills.
They can't go out and enjoy life. They can't go out and spend money at the movies. Every dollar they make is to pay their bills.
86% of West Virginia's power comes from coal, but coal has become one of the most expensive ways to generate electricity. That's why West Virginia ranks 49th in the country in electricity affordability in a review of 2020 data. President Donald Trump wants the country to increase coal production, save coal-fired power plants from retirement, and reopen closed ones. Chris Hamilton is president of the West Virginia Coal Association. He wants the state to double its coal production to a level it had before natural gas displaced coal.
We think under this new political leadership and with the industries and government working hand in hand, we can get back to that 165 million tons of coal.
He says with power plants burning more coal, they should become more efficient, which in turn could lower electricity costs. Other state leaders say coal is needed to power the growth of data centers. West Virginia Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito was at the White House when Trump championed coal.
It also helps us with that baseload energy that we so much need when we hear about energy shortages for AI, data centers, and the creation of a more electrified economy.
So far, West Virginia's major utilities haven't committed to using more coal, saying it could raise costs for customers. They say new electricity demand would be met with natural gas or wind and solar. Dennis Wamsted is an analyst with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. He says Trump's policies, at most, will delay the closure of some coal-fired power plants. Utilities plan for the next 40 years, he says, not the next four.
I do not see a new coal plant ever being built in the United States. They're too expensive.
The major utility in southern West Virginia, Appalachian Power, is asking regulators to raise rates to make up for inflation and storm repair costs. Residents, meanwhile, are finding ways to save money. Gary Bolin, a disabled Navy veteran who lives on a fixed income, tries to use power sparingly.
I keep my thermostat set at 65, so I don't have a power bill that high.
And he switched his heating source.
I had to transfer over to gas because the electric heat was running way too high. At one time, I had a $500 bill.
West, the former coal miner, says she'd encourage anyone to switch to solar in West Virginia.
Well, you know, God's sun is out every day.
State regulators will consider Appalachian Power's rate increase this summer. For NPR News, I'm Curtis Tate in Beckley, West Virginia.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. For decades, America has been considered one of the safest places in the world to invest. But now a shift is happening. President Trump's sweeping tariffs did come as a shock to global markets, and they're raising a big question. Are foreign investors losing their confidence in the U.S.? NPR senior business editor Rafael Nam has been following this and joins us now. Hi, Rafael.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so explain more. What exactly is going on here?
So I think by now most people have seen how volatile the stock market has been since President Trump unveiled his tariffs earlier this month. I mean, just today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 1,000 points, or more than 2%. What's stunning, though, is that we are also seeing declines in U.S. government bonds and the U.S. dollar, all at the same time. To have stocks, bonds, and the dollar all fall together is very rare.
Yeah.
Usually, as people get nervous and stocks fall, investors buy bonds and the dollar because they are considered to be so safe. So when I called around to ask about this, the word that came up most was unprecedented.
Unprecedented. Okay, so what are some of the explanations for why this may be happening?
Well, one explanation is that this is just a reaction to tariff news that really shocked investors. So this could be just sophisticated investors adjusting their portfolios to what many think is an extreme policy. But there is another possible explanation that has people really worried.
And what's that explanation?
Well, that foreign investors start selling off their American investments. That's the big fear. I mean, it's hard to know for sure because it's hard to track every single trade happening in financial markets and who's behind them.
Right.
But typically, when you see the major markets in a country all fall at once, it's a sign that foreign investors are heading to the exits. The Asian financial crisis back in the late 1990s is an example. Now, it's too soon to say we are in a crisis, but there are genuine concerns that, at the very least, trust in the U.S. has been shaken.
And Rafael, is that because these tariffs turned out to be so much larger than expected?
Somewhat, but it's actually more than that. The one thing investors absolutely hate is uncertainty. But that's what many investors feel they're seeing now all the time, like the chaotic firings we've seen across the federal government, for example. And now Trump is attacking the Federal Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell, for not cutting interest rates, injecting even more uncertainty. I talked to Mark Chandler from Bannockburn Capital Markets, and he put it to me this way.
You know, it takes us a long time to build up trust with friends, with wives, lovers, and yet it can be like lost in a second. And I think that trust is going to be hard for the U.S. to regain.
And that's the fear, that foreign investors will stop investing in the U.S. because their confidence is shaken.
And what would be the fallout if foreign investors did indeed stop having confidence in the U.S., you think?
The effects could be quite significant because foreign investors are so critical to the U.S. financial system. Foreign investors own more than $8 trillion of U.S. government bonds. And when they buy bonds, they're effectively lending money to the U.S.
Right.
And because there are so many investors willing to buy bonds, the U.S. doesn't have to pay out high interest rates and can continue to spend money. It's like having a credit card with low interest rates that makes spending money more affordable. But say one day that credit card company decides you're just too financially risky and decides to stop lending you money unless you're willing to pay much higher interest rates. That's the fear when it comes to foreign investors, that the U.S. will have to pay much higher interest rates to keep them, which would make it more expensive for the country to spend money.
Okay, and what do you think that would mean in terms of the U.S.'s standing in the world?
Oh, that's potentially quite historic. The U.S. financial market has been considered to be the safest in the world for decades. Could that be changing? That's what many people in markets are fearing now.
That is NPR's Rafael Nam. Thank you so much, Rafael.
Thank you, Elsa.
It's the stuff of nightmares. Bats flying out of their caves by the thousands, sometimes tens of thousands. Across the world, it happens every night. And for the bats, you might think it was a nightmare too, a traffic nightmare.
So they can be really close to each other. Usually they are a centimeter from one another when they just emerge.
Aya Goldstein is a researcher at the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior, and she says the bats, they fly out fast and they are packed together.
25 bats a second emerge from the cave.
But unlike our human highways, collisions are rare.
Well, Goldstein and her team wanted to know why. Their findings were published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. For starters, bats do use their eyes. They can see, but they also sense their environment with high-frequency sounds that echo off objects, that is, echolocation.
So when a bat emits an echolocation call, it waits to the reflected echo in order to get information about the object that is in front of it. And it can get information about the distance of the object, the size and the texture of the object. And it can say if this is an insect or a bat or a mountain in front of it.
Normally, that is a navigation superpower. But imagine you're a little bat shooting out your pings, surrounded by thousands of your friends, all doing the same thing. With so much sound bouncing back, how do you know which signal is yours?
The bat will hear the echolocation of the other bat. It will not hear its own echo. And if you cannot hear your reflected echo of your echolocation, you don't have information.
Just like other forms of signal interference, researchers call this jamming.
We understood they probably cannot maneuver without colliding with this kind of severe acoustic interference. But we know that they do that. We know that they are rarely collide.
So, what's their secret?
To find out, Goldstein and her team staked out a cave in Israel, home to lots of greater mouse-tailed bats. The team attached tiny location trackers and microphones to their backs.
These ultrasonic microphones that allow us to record the echolocation of the specific bat, but also the other bats that fell around it.
When the bats emerged, the team was able to record how they were moving and, crucially, how they were echolocating. And here is what Goldstein found.
At the moment that they leave the cave, there is like 94% jamming.
But within seconds, they are able to reduce the jamming to 40%. And that's because they change how they echolocate.
They increase a bit the frequency of the echolocation. The calls are shorter. And they're also weaker.
That lets them focus right in on the bat in front of them.
That's the most important information that they need.
As long as they don't hit that bat, they tend not to hit anyone. Traffic jam averted. Now, there is one other secret to their crash-free flying, Goldstein says. Once they leave the cave, they just spread out a bit.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. With a docking location in central Paris, Viking is dedicated to bringing curious travelers closer to destinations across.